If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Diego came to Drake's ships at Nombre de Dios when he landed there in 1573 and called out to Drake's men to ask if it was Drake's ship, and it demanded to be brought on board even though they were actually shooting at him at the time.
That was Miranda Kaufman on board a replica of the Golden Hind.
And why Timbuktu? Well, Timbuktu, it represents one of the great bodies of written historical material anywhere on Earth.
And that was Gus Casely-Hayford describing the history of Timbuktu. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Matt Elton and I'm the section editor of BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. It is available in all good newsagents, or you can take out a subscription from anywhere in the world. Visit historyextra.com/subscribe-today for the latest subscription offers. We also have digital editions available for the iPad, the Kindle Fire, Google Play, and Zinio. For details of all of these digital formats, head to historyextra.com/digital. Dr. Miranda Kaufman is a historian specialising in the story of Africans in Britain. For the latest in our History Explorer series, she visited a replica of Francis Drake's Golden Hind ship in Brixham, in the company of the magazine's production editor, Spencer Mizzen. Tudor explorer Francis Drake encountered many Africans on his travels, and some even joined his crew, as Miranda explained.
Hello, I'm here aboard the Golden Hind in Brixham with historian Miranda Kaufman to discuss Sir Francis Drake's famous circumnavigation of the globe, which started in 1577, and more specifically, the presence of a black man named Diego on that voyage. So, Miranda, how did Diego come to be on the Golden Hind?
Well, Diego had actually met Drake some 4 years before in Panama when the two of them were part of a successful joint raid on a Spanish silver plate fleet as it was crossing the Isthmus of Panama. So they'd known each other for four years by the time the Golden Hind set sail in 1577.
Right, we're stood next to the captain's cabin on the Golden Hind. Miranda, can you tell me, how did Diego meet Francis Drake?
So Diego was a Cimmeroon, which means that he was an African who had been enslaved by the Spaniards, taken across the Atlantic, but then run away from the Spanish mines in the Spanish Caribbean. And when he met Diego, he was part of the Cimmeroon settlement in Panama. And Diego came to Drake's ships at Nombre de Dios when he landed there in 1573 and called out to Drake's men to ask if it was Drake's ship, and it demanded to be brought on board, even though they were actually shooting at him at the time. And he was one of the key go-betweens between the English and the Cimmeroons. And they had this incredibly successful attack on the Spanish silver when they were transporting it across the land over the Isthmus of Panama. And between them, they raided the silver and gold and did pretty well out of it. In fact, Drake gave the Cimmeroon leader a gilt scimitar, which is a kind of sword that had previously belonged to Henry II of France.
So, Miranda, what would life have been like for Diego on the boat? How would he have been treated by his fellow crew members?
Well, so we don't know much about Diego's life in between coming back from Panama in 1573, and then he sets out on the gold. We find him again on the Golden Hind in 1577, and it seems from the accounts of the time that he was on board as Drake's personal manservant. So he had quite a kind of special role on the ship, and he basically was at Drake's beck and call. And so he probably spent quite a lot of time in or by the cabin waiting to do whatever Drake asked of him next, from fetching him water to running errands about the ship.
And what happened to Diego?
Well, Diego was part of a party from the ship that landed on an island called Mocha Isle off the coast of Chile in November 1578. And the local people of that island were not particularly pleased to see Drake and his men, and they attacked them with arrows. And Drake was quite badly wounded, and so was Diego. But he seems to have held on and actually only died from his wounds almost a year later near the Moluccas, near modern-day Indonesia.
We're next to the Barbara Surgeon cabin below decks. Miranda, what happened to Diego after he received his wounds?
Well, the only facts we have from the voyage account is that he was wounded on Mocha Isle by the arrow fire, and that he eventually died from his wounds near the Moluccas. But what we can look at the history of medicine on board Tudor ships and imagine what that really meant for that almost a year where he was wounded. The Mary Rose has an intact barber surgeon's chest with all the instruments, some copies of which we can see here. And, medicine at the time was fairly basic and brutal. They definitely didn't have any an anaesthetic. Yeah. But actually, the thing that's most likely to have killed him is the wound becoming infected or gangrenous. And that was most likely killed him, because it obviously wasn't a bad enough wound to kill him straight away.
And that happened quite some time, possibly, after he received the wounds.
Yes, because the anonymous account of Drake's voyage that this information comes from says that he didn't die till they were near the Moluccas, the Spice Islands.
Sure. And how unusual was it for a black man to be on an English ship in the 16th century?
Well, not as unusual as you might think. If you think about it, as we were just saying, there were lots of ways to die on a Tudor ship. There's a high mortality rate, but it needed a certain number of crew of men on board to keep it sailing. And so there are cases, for example, in 1582, when on Fenton's voyage, where he calls at Guinea, he takes on four Africans on board to replace crew members who have died. And the voyage accounts of the period often refer to Africans on board English ships.
Right, we're back above decks on the Golden Hind in the lovely Devon sunshine. Miranda, you were saying that it wasn't that unusual for black people to be on English boats in the 16th century. So were there any other Africans on the Golden Hind during Drake's circumnavigation?
It's funny you should ask me that. it turns out that these same voyage accounts show that there were at least three other Africans on the Golden Hind at various points in the voyage, mostly when Drake was attacking various Spanish ships off the coast of Spanish America, the West Coast. So he picks up two African men, one at Paita and one at Guatulco. And the one we know most about is a woman called Maria, possibly Francesca, but probably Maria. She's referred to with different names in different sources. But she was met Drake off the coast of Nicaragua. She was on a Spanish ship that was coming back from China, belonging to a Spaniard called Zarate. And Drake took her on board at that point in April 1579 until December of that year, when Drake abandoned her on an island called Crab Island near in Indonesia, along with these two other African men whose names we don't know. So it's not entirely clear the exact circumstances of this episode, but we do know that William Camden said that Drake had purchased much blame for this action, and we also know that Maria was by this point heavily pregnant, and that must have had a bearing on the decision-making process. Some people argue that he left her here because he was ashamed that she was heavily pregnant, because there were rumours that he himself might have been the father or one of his gentlemen sailors, and that would have been embarrassing when they came back to England. Apparently it was embarrassing anyway, because they found out anyway. Yeah. But when Drake's nephew, who might be biased, in the other direction, when he was caught up by the Spanish Inquisition some years later, he said that they'd left the three Africans on Crab Island to found their own settlement there, and they'd left them with food. But he also mentions that there's no running water on the island. So we don't know who to believe, but it's clear that Maria was on the boat for half of 1579, and probably that being the only woman on board a ship of 60 Tudor sailors was probably not a very pleasant experience.
Yeah, well, imagine. And how many black people do we think would have been in England at the time?
So I've been there looking through parish registers, household accounts, tax returns, court records, anything I can get my hands on. I've found records of over 360 individuals in Britain, that's England and Scotland, between 1500 and 1640. And that may just be the ones we can have archival records of, so there may be more. There were certainly the larger groups that sort of came and went, and I think we have to remember that Tudor England was a lot more of a cosmopolitan place than we sometimes imagine.
And how would most of them got to England and Scotland, and under what circumstances?
Well, I think, again, we have to understand this in the context of the Africans in the world at this time. So as a result of Portuguese and Spanish activity in Africa and across the Atlantic world, by the Tudor period, there are already Africans living in much of southern Europe and across the Caribbean and South America, as well as just in Africa. So whenever England had contact with any of those places, Africans could come to England. I mean, for example, there were 10% of Lisbon was of African origin in 1550. So when royals or aristocrats or merchants travelled to England from Europe, they might bring Africans with them. We find records of Africans in Italian and Portuguese merchant households in London and Southampton, but also if people like Drake are raiding the Spanish Caribbean, as he does in 1585-6, or capturing privateering ships as privateers, capturing Spanish ships as prizes, those ships might well have Africans on board, and they were brought back to England as well. And on a smaller scale, the English do begin trade directly with Africa from the middle of the 16th century onwards, and small groups of Africans were brought back as a result of that to be trained, to be taught English, and then trained and taken back to Africa to work as trade interpreters and factors.
Do you think that number will surprise a lot of people now to hear that there is that many black Africans in the country at the time?
Well, certainly some people I've spoken to have been surprised, and others have said that they're not surprised. But I think that more people need to know that they were here.
Sure. And what do you think we can do to spread the word, as it were?
Well, we can share this podcast with as many people as possible. But I think it's about asking different questions of the past. I think, yeah. This is British history, but it's an aspect of British history that has not been centre stage in the past. And I think that...
What do you think that is?
I think that until the 20th century, historians have mostly been interested in questions of high politics and war and looking at great men and how they became great and what so the whole focus of history has shifted over the last century to look more at the lives of ordinary people. And I think that the new research into the history of Africans in this country is actually part of a much wider shift towards looking at social history and the kinds of questions we ask of the past. And I think, obviously, I think some of these questions are definitely coming from present-centred concerns, but I think it's important to incorporate these histories into our general idea of British history and to show that this island has been... has had immigrants coming to it for centuries and not just recently.
So there's a bit of a perception that immigration began with a Windrush just after the war. I mean, do you think that's something we need to challenge?
Well, it's just completely and utterly wrong. we have there were Libyans in the Roman army serving on Hadrian's Wall. There have been Africans coming here at least since Roman times, possibly before, and certainly by the Tudor period there were plenty, and by the Georgian period there's estimated sort of 10,000 to 15,000 Africans in England. So yes, I mean, you just need to get your facts straight, don't you?
And how would, especially in, say, the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, how would black people have been received by the people of England and Scotland?
Well, this is something that's more difficult to tell, but I think that the very fact that they were being baptised and buried and married sometimes in the Church of England shows a certain kind of level of acceptance in English society. And it's also important to stress that it was not legally possible to be a slave under English common law. So a ruling of 1569 ruled that the air of England is too pure an air for slaves to breathe in.
Right.
I mean, what's quite interesting is that although it wasn't legally possible to enslave Africans in England, once you set sail in a ship like this, things changed. I think when Tudor sailors were sailing around the Atlantic world, they sort of took things as they found them, and if they met an African merchant, they might trade with them. If they met an African king, they might send them a diplomatic mission. But if they met Africans who had already been enslaved by the Spanish, they might they might buy some of them from the Spanish to replenish missing crew. But then equally, as we learned with Drake and the Cimmeroons, when they had a shared objective of capturing Spanish silver, for example, they were more than happy to work together, to their mutual benefit.
So Miranda, apparently Drake's circumnavigation of the globe wasn't the only voyage where he came into contact with black Africans. I wonder if you could explain a bit about that.
Yeah, so as we saw, actually, as a young man, Drake had actually been on one of John Hawkins's early slaving voyages in the 1560s. But then later in his career, we saw that he makes these alliances with the Cimmeroons in Panama. And again, he's got these Africans on his circumnavigation voyage. But Drake again raids the Caribbean in 1585-6. And on that voyage, almost every port that he lands on, places like Cartagena in modern-day Colombia, Africans actually run away from the Spaniards to join Drake's ships. And there's a really interesting poem about Drake's raid on Cartagena where it says that, because it's amazing, when you look at the way he attacks the town, he manages to attack it on the only beach where he's got information about where the best place to land is, because they've put poison stakes on the beaches and stuff to protect themselves from this pirate that they called El Dracon. but it says in this poem that the reason he knows this is because these two African fishermen tell him. So he meets these African fishermen near Cartagena and they tell him where to attack. So there's this interesting relationship there, and in a way the English raid was a sort of form of escape for these Africans who weren't sure maybe how they were going to be treated by the English, but thought it must have been better from either way they were being treated by the Spanish at
Couldn't
the time.
Get any worse, yeah.
And so actually a lot of Africans do get on Drake's ships on that voyage, and He takes them all to Roanoke, where the English are starting to set up a colony. But actually, when they get there, the colonists are not enjoying themselves, and there's a big storm. And in fact, a lot of them probably died in the storm. But we do have records that could be tied up from the English records, which of Africans who must have come to England as a result of that voyage.
Yeah.
And there's in fact one who gets as far as Paris, who is right. Yeah, the ambassador to Paris writes back about him.
And can you tell me about the Drake jewel?
There's a portrait of Francis Drake from 1591 where the one piece of jewellery that he's wearing is this large jewel on a belt round his waist. And it's a really it's in the Victoria and Albert Museum now. It's a really impressive gem-studded object that opens up to show a little miniature of Elizabeth the First. So we know that Elizabeth the First gave it to him certainly before this portrait was painted, but probably after his circumnavigation voyage and his knighthood. And on the front of it has this very arresting image of an African man's head in profile on top of the profile of a white woman. And an English woman. I think that now we know a bit more about the history of Drake's alliances with the Simeroons and Diego, his relationship with Diego. I think that puts an interesting new perspective on this image, and perhaps it can be read as a symbol of this fruitful alliance between the African Simeroons and the English. You know, perhaps the English woman is actually meant to be Elizabeth, and
right.
You know, maybe this is a symbol of that alliance against their mutual foe, the Spaniards.
That was Miranda Kaufman in the company of Spencer Mizzen. Miranda has written an article on Africans in Tudor and Stuart Britain in our April issue, which is out now. Also in the issue, Professor Ian Kershaw questions why Adolf Hitler fascinates us more than any other historical monsters. Meanwhile, we're exploring the mysteries of Shakespeare's life, challenging myths about Pocahontas, and discovering how beans were once thought to be a powerful aphrodisiac. Look out for our April issue in all good newsagents and in many digital formats. Speaking of our digital formats, we are currently running a special promotion whereby you can purchase several of our back issues for a greatly reduced price of just 99 pence each in the UK or 99 cents in the US. It applies to iPad, iPhone, Kindle Fire and Google Play. To take advantage of this offer, please visit the newsstand on your device or head to immediateapps.com, where you can also find great deals from some of our sister titles. The offer ends on Easter Monday, so get in while you can. And now we have a short advertisement break.
In his 250,000 copy bestseller, The Secret Life of Bletchley Park, Sinclair Mackay told the story of the ordinary men and women thrown together to do extraordinary things. His follow-up, The Secret Listeners, revealed the stories behind the codebreakers, people sent across the world on life-changing adventures to intercept German messages for decoding back at Bletchley Park. Now, in his new book, The Lost World of Bletchley Park, An Illustrated History of the Wartime Codebreaking Centre, Sinclair Mackay gives an unparalleled glimpse of a lost world and tells the history of a building and the people who work there like no other.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest, whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster.
And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Before our next interview, it's time for the latest history news with our website editor, Emma McFarnan.
All evidence points to the Leicester skeleton belonging to Richard III, leading archaeologist Mike Pitts has said. In an exclusive interview with History Extra, the editor of British Archaeology insisted that, taken together, the DNA testing, radiocarbon dating and damage to the skeleton prove that the remains belong to the former king. Cumulatively, the evidence makes a very convincing case, he said. We cannot be 100% certain that it's him. There has to be, in any historical situation, an element of doubt. But sometimes we recognise that the doubt is so small that it's insignificant. For all practical purposes, we can say that the Leicester skeleton is Richard's. His comments came in response to doubts about the identity of the skeleton raised by Michael Hicks, head of history at the University of Winchester, and Martin Biddle, archaeologist and director of the Winchester Research Unit. In interviews with BBC History magazine, the pair raised concerns about tests carried out on the skeleton and called for field records to be made publicly available. In other news, unprecedented detail about the age, diet and health of eight mummies has been revealed by new technology that virtually unwraps them. Curators at the British Museum have collaborated with scientists and medical experts to use CT scans and 3D visualisation to better understand how people lived and died in the ancient Nile Valley. From the museum's collection of 120 mummies, the team selected eight significant individuals and used non-invasive scanning techniques to learn about their age at death, health problems suffered during life, and the manner of mummification. The findings are detailed in a new book, Ancient Lives, New Discoveries, published to accompany a major interactive exhibition at the British Museum. Meanwhile, the remains of an 18th century ship exposed off the Northumberland coast last year after a tidal surge, has been designated a scheduled ancient monument by English Heritage. The wreck, which lays about 650 metres off Bamborough Castle, now has added protection, making it an offence to damage it. A study suggests that the vessel dates from about 1770 and was probably English.
Thanks for that, Emma. Don't forget to visit historyextra.com for all the latest history news. A couple of weeks ago, we broadcast a talk from last year's History Weekend Festival in Malmesbury, and after a positive response from listeners to that, we've decided to bring you another one. This time, it's Gus Casely-Hayford, a cultural historian who presented Lost Kingdoms of Africa on BBC television. For his talk, Gus delved into the history of one of Africa's most important cities, Timbuktu.
At the beginning of this year, and perhaps some of you as well, watched in horror as many of Mali's most ancient monuments were deliberately damaged and some of them actually destroyed. And it was a campaign of what appeared to be systematic vandalism by a group called Ansardine, and that they're a sort of Islamic militia, and they pushed further and further south from their desert strongholds, and they began to threaten these areas of great historical importance. They destroyed tombs, they burnt manuscripts, and they damaged buildings. It was thankfully followed a matter of weeks later by the liberation of Timbuktu by French and West African forces. But it was a bit of a short-lived relief. I mean, I'm sure some of you will remember that news reports actually showed the forces uncovering the extent of the damage that these irreplaceable archives and libraries of Timbuktu were destroyed. Simply no more. I mean, it's just completely unthinkable. I mean, for me, I found it a bit of... It was like slow-motion torture, the gradual unfolding of a disaster. And the flow of evidence seemed to confirm the absolute unthinkable, that these libraries, medieval libraries, completely unique, were no more. And it made me really think about what I do and why I do it. And thankfully, the years ended with one or two positive bits of news. The rebel forces have been routed. There have been elections in Mali. There's a new president, and the president's appointed a new prime minister, Umu Tatum Lai, and he is a really interesting man. He's actually a Sorbonne-trained historian, and he's the son of another great historian, Ibrahim Lai, and they're part of a fantastic tradition of Malians who have really respected their past. So one hopes that it's the beginning of a more positive narrative. And when I began the Lost Kingdoms project, I really wasn't sure how it might turn out. You know, I wanted to uncover some of the latest African archaeology, to absorb some of the most insightful thinking in the area of African history. And whilst at the same time immersing myself in contemporary Africa. But I didn't know how all of this would fit together into coherent journeys. And in a way, my hope was a little bit like some of those Enlightenment travellers who visited Italy and Greece, that I might find timeless truths, universal lessons that might be uncovered in the old world. I wanted to pursue history, yes, but I was very keen that these journeys, that they wouldn't just uncover Africa's past. And at the end of 2 years of travelling, driving from the very high Atlas Mountains across the Sahara, from the Great Lakes of Central Africa to the golden beaches on the Swahili coast, from the adobe mosques of West Africa to the mega cities like Lagos, from Great Zimbabwe to the battlefields where the Zulu fought their wars. And I was just deeply affected by that period of travel, by those experiences. And just the things I learned, you know, that the largest mud-built buildings are African. You know, the oldest ceramic traditions. You know, Africa is so much more than just the home of humankind. You know, from the very earliest times, it's pushed the boundaries of creativity to produce some truly astounding things. And it's always been a place of ferocious innovation. And seeing the material proof of that for the first time has been a really deep privilege. And if the history, after all that travel, I have to think back on it, if the history has revealed any single pan-continental thing, it's that many of the conditions, the issues, the scenarios, the motivations that triggered the major events in ancient times, they still seem to resonate today. The battle for the resources that drove the politics of ancient Sudan, it still continues. The doctrinal ructions that destabilized the big Moroccan kingdoms, they're still resonant. Over millennia, many of the big issues that drove ancient politics have continued to crackle over time. The inter-ethnic struggles that fueled the development of 18th century South African politics, that they continue. The tension between regional ethnic sociology across West Africa, those things still endure. These patterns remain. And what's so interesting is to watch how Africans have dealt with that history. They continue to reapply lessons from that history. But with that comes the knowledge that for many fighting for African causes, history is often used as a tool of war. And what remains really powerful about what's happened in Mali is that in Ansar Dine's case, they saw the potential destruction of Mali's most important monuments and cultural assets as a way of turning the war. That they actually, as they retreated, they thought the most powerful thing that we can do is to destroy historical narrative. And as I watched the news of Timbuktu, I felt actually physically unwell. And it runs so much counter to things that the Malians that I've met and know believe in. And it was more than vandalism or even iconoclasm. It was actually an attempt, in my mind, to deconstruct the national identity by destroying some of the totemic anchors of shared heritage. And I think the hope from their perspective was that in unravelling that knot that held people together, that history, that sociology would simply unravel. And that's the power of history. And why Timbuktu? Well, Timbuktu, it represents one of the great bodies of written historical material anywhere on Earth, but particularly within Africa, where there is so little in the way of written bodies of material. There are 700,000 medieval documents held in Timbuktu, or there were until earlier this year, ranging from scholarly works to short letters. And many of them are preserved in private libraries. It's a region that has long attracted researchers and religious scholars, and it became the home of a number of Sufis. They're sort of like saints in the Christian tradition. They're venerated religious figures. And the painful irony is that the destruction of the tombs and the libraries is, you know, it actually puts in jeopardy many of the traditions, many of the ancient histories that I imagine the groups like Ansar Dine, if they actually sat down and thought about it, would be enormously proud of. I mean, its libraries have been important beyond the region for centuries. At its peak in the 16th century, the university was as influential as any other on Earth. And it's a city, as it was then, of 100,000 people, but there were 25,000 students. And it was a period which was critical in the development of Islamic scholarship. And Timbuktu was right at the heart of what was happening. Its growth and cultural dynamism were all driven by Islamic scholarship. And at the beginning of this year, those 24 private libraries, that they held this incredible repository of manuscripts, unmatched anywhere else in Africa. It was a collection that, through an Islamic frame, offered a unique window onto the development of one of Africa's greatest empires. And it also gave an insight into the thinking of just about everything. And if you actually had got to those libraries, and if you sit down and you actually read some of those scripts, they tell you all about this medieval city. But they also tell you things about algebra. There are incredible recipes, amazing recipes. There are huge tracts on the movement of the stars, on physics, on all sorts of things. This was an incredible centre of learning, and this was an amazing body of written material. And for these people who have pride in Islam, the destruction of the buildings and the tombs and the libraries was a profound act, in my mind, of stupid vandalism. And even if Ansar Dine supports Sharia law, and that means, of course, that they oppose anything but the purest Quranic texts, this incomparably important body of material in Timbuktu is at the nexus of a number of important African narratives that I think that we should all respect, irrespective of our religion. If they truly wanted to build a new African narrative, define a new centre of intellectual thinking, something that would rival things that were going on in the West, if they wanted to build an intellectual tradition that was based on the tenets of Islam, Timbuktu is a fantastic ancient model. And it's a place that should be venerated rather than vandalised. But as the dust has begun to settle, the most defiant librarians have started to reconstitute their archives. And there are stories emerging that as some of the archivists fled, they actually took some of their libraries with them. I mean, some have actually resorted to, there's a very ancient tradition, because this sort of thing has happened in the past. And in the old days, what they would do, they would flee into the desert and they would bury their collections. And there's a hope that that has happened. But today, almost a year since the siege began, many of the archives remain empty, abandoned, burned out. One of Africa's greatest historical resources, perhaps irreparably damaged. Watching the reports on television, it took me back to my last visit to the city. And I visited many, many libraries in Africa. And despite Hegel's view that Africa has no history, it's the only, well, in my mind, it's not only a continent that has an embarrassment of history. It's developed unrivaled systems for charting and for holding those stories, for promoting history. There are thousands of small archives, of textile stores, of drum stores, that have become more than just repositories for manuscripts, for material culture. They become fonts of communal narrative, symbols of continuity. But even in that very special context, Timbuktu is exceptional, so special. I have a really vivid memory of standing in one of the side rooms, one of the smaller libraries in Timbuktu. And you have to imagine it's a semi-lit space. And it's heavy with that very particular... I mean, anyone who's visited an old library will have a sense of what I'm talking about, of that smell that comes with accumulated book dust over centuries. But this is book dust that's been built up over a millennium of use. And that tang of old tanned leather. And you can actually taste the past on your lips. You can see the sort of bits of desiccated parchment on the light. Feel it under your eyelids. See it suspended in the amber light. And the actual air becomes kind of thick with the soup of the past. You know, bits of corporeal history surrounding one. And my first trip into one of these spaces and sitting in there, and I became conscious of the fact that, I mean, probably many of you do, you love history as much as I do, is this feeling that so much of my time that I spend in archives isn't because I'm seeking out a particular historical fact or trying to push a particular narrative. You know, most of the time I've been driven there by something much less concrete, just by a kind of experiential longing, simply to be close to history, to old things. And this is a place in which you really can feel that ambiently. But I've always thought that there's something more, little more magical than breathing in the atmosphere around important documents, of handling inventories, legal papers, of the sorts of things that help you to reanimate dormant bits of the past. And then you feel sometimes you can almost gain a bit of vicarious intimacy. And with so much African history, this is such a rare thing because there are so few of these kinds of archives. And it's a very special place because from the 1300s, this was one of the most powerful kingdoms in West Africa. And it's a continuity that begins then and remains, and that is a very rare thing. And it comes to prominence in that period because it's then that the Emperor Mansa Musa comes to prominence. And he is the richest man, not just in Africa, but possibly in the world, but even possibly that ever lived. He had vast gold reserves. And he sent envoys to the courts of Europe, to the Middle East. And Timbuktu's wealth and power developed because the city became the hub of the most lucrative intercontinental trade. Berber merchants from North Africa, they came south across the desert and they brought with them salt, textiles, new precious goods, and learning right into the heart of West Africa. But there was also a similar nexus of learning that actually came from the south, from the heart of West Africa. And they all brought their knowledge, their thinking, their trade goods here to be exchanged in Timbuktu, this new economic, cultural, intellectual hub. But this is a story that I actually think is told best when you give it some context. And it's a story that actually goes back almost as far as any human story can, with corroboration, to a place called Onjugu. And Onjugu sits on the bend of the River Niger. And the source of the River Niger is way up in the Guinea Highlands. It's the third longest river in Africa. And by the time it gets to Mali, it's become kind of very kind of slow and indolent, and it spreads into this huge plateau, and all of its tributaries have created this very verdant, lush, fertile region. And it's actually been known for centuries as the breadbasket of this particular area. And its ecological cycles of flood and retreat, that they've encouraged over centuries a massive web of human economies. There are fisher folk who live beside the river, rice agriculturalists who work on its banks, millet farmers who work as far away from the floods as they possibly can, but close enough to get water. There are pastoralists who work around the delta as well. So all of these different communities over millennia have made this an incredibly rich place. But Onjugu is a fascinating place to start, because here, where the Niger has defined this region for centuries, you get a sense of the complexity of the history that has wrought by this particular area. I mean, recently, after a storm, not very long ago, a riverbank collapsed, and it exposed layers of archaeological sediment. And what archaeologists have found is that pottery that tells a story of 11,500 years of history. You know, even a superficial look along the riverbank, if you walk along, it's pretty staggering. There are tiny little shards, most of them no bigger than my thumb. But they have a kind of power that pottery of that age does. You know, if you hold a little piece in your hand, you can feel it sort of almost vibrate just with a kind of feeling of meaning. And this ceramic activity, 2,000 years older than any other pottery in Africa to date, the same age as the oldest pottery that's found in Japan. But you can see pieces that resemble the kinds of pottery that is still made. You know, bits with the external edges which have been roughened and textured, corrugations that have been made in the wet clay. And they made those corrugations not just for decoration, that they made them so that they would trap moisture. And the reason they trap moisture is so that the exterior of the pot could be cooled. And this was a kind of technology which was absolutely vital in the storage of food and in the development of trade. I mean, this region may not have a particularly Islamic story to tell, but it has a story which is founded upon these more ancient and indigenous narratives. People were storing their foods using fired pottery, probably trading from this region more than 9 millennia before the birth of Muhammad. This pre-Islamic story is a really fascinating one for me. Its technologies inform so much of what Mali is today. The seeds of the intellectual and trading traditions that have defined the whole region are evident in these banks and can be pulled from little fragments that are found on the banks of this river. And fairly close by, this is another view of the excavations, fairly close by. This is the Bandagara Escarpment, and the story continues. And this is if you get a chance, please do visit this region. It's amazing. This is the Bandagara Escarpment, and if you get up onto the top of it and you're looking northeast, it's the beginning of the Sahel and beyond the desert. But if you stand on the top and you look south, southwest, it's green and it's lush. And this huge escarpment, 500 meters high in certain parts of sandstone, it stretches for a mile and it actually cuts this kind of amazing scar across Mali. And the view from the top, it's absolutely unforgettable. And it's the legendary home of a group called the Telem. And there's a belief that the Telem had the power to fly, and you can guess why. And nestled in the tops of these cliffs are one of the wonders of West Africa. We can't pick up this story in a way that is chronologically contiguous from Djougou, but there are themes here that you can see that resonate across time. The escarpment is actually studded with a honeycomb of complex caves, some natural, but some have been extended by this group, the Telem, and they extended them before the time of Christ. And these were farming communities who grew crops and hunted down on the valley floor. And then they retreated up into caves on the escarpment walls. And what is left of these caves offers a really stunning insight into their world. These were areas which are just set in the overhang beneath the tops of the caves. And these were enormous, cathedral-like. And the Telem made their homes here. But they also made these amazing adobe granaries. And they made them from the clay which is found in termite mounds. And it's a really highly resistant material because the termites eat a lot of cellulose, that makes these structures incredibly strong. And they are beautiful, they sort of glisten. And that they were used for storing their grain. But they also made all kinds of pottery. But the ability to make pottery, to store their foods in these huge grain silos, it changed the way in which the Telem could operate. This meant that they actually had time to do the sorts of things that their hunter-gatherer predecessors couldn't. They discovered art, in a sense, for themselves. The kinds of decorations that you saw pressed into the surface of those pots in Djougou, usually made by a bulrush being rubbed along the external surface of wet clay. Here, it's replicated as just a beautiful design. There, it's in a way that they are shaking hands with that past visually, but here they're doing it purely out of a love of culture. And today, it's a wonderful place to go if you get the chance, just to rub your digits in the marks made by someone possibly 2,000 years ago. And it suggests that people could think about things more than just their basic needs, that they were thinking about beauty, about aesthetics. And it's an interesting climacteric, an interesting moment of transition for the people in this region. And you can see here as well how the kinds of forms that are used in the great mosques that are found in places like Timbuktu, made from the same materials, you can begin to see how there's a connectivity to something which was pre-Islamic. The mystical Telem, they actually disappeared almost as mysteriously as they'd come. And they were replaced by the Dogon. It's not known how they died out. And it may be that they overlap. The Dogon, that they continued to use these caves, but they used them in a completely different way. They respected this past. But the way in which they venerated this past was that they would take the bodies of their dead up into these caves, and they would lay their late loved ones out under these overhangs. And today, if you walk, it's difficult because under your feet are the bones of generations of Dogon, bleached bones. And in a way, it's them venerating their predecessors, the Telen. These people, these mysterious people who had the power of flight. But the Dogon also found other ways of reflecting that past. They borrowed similar systems of pattern making for their own grain stores. This is a Dogon grain store. And you can see that it's got this beautiful carved wooden door. And you see carved modern replicas of these doors. You can buy them in tourist shops all over West Africa and also in the West as well. But this is how they would have been originally used. And what they're doing here is in part saying, we are Dogon, we are different. But at the same time, there is a nod to the ancient Telem. The actual structures themselves that surround the wooden doors are made in the same way, from the same kinds of technologies as the Telem. Within the actual panel, the carved wooden panel that makes up the door, there are stories, and they're all stories of where the Dogon came from, of stories of origin, but also carved into it are wonderful textured decoration that link again back to the kind of pattern mating that you saw on the Telem granaries and on those wonderful pots that were uncovered in Onjuga. And you see these traditions also manifest in Timbuktu. You know, there, when buildings are built, you don't just build a building in the traditional Islamic way. There, even today, in contemporary Timbuktu, you would still call upon a mason, on a builder, who could evoke the power of the past, of ancestors, of ghosts. And this is a city which, this is an archaeological dig that went on in Djene Djeno, which is fairly close to the Dogon region. And it's an exceptional place, again, which, like the area on Djougou, it was only relatively recently discovered. I mean, this was dug up in 1977 by a team of archaeologists. And there was what seemed to be a fairly unassuming mound of earth. But what they discovered there was archaeological material which was 5 meters deep and went on for a vast area, acres and acres. And if you walk there, it's unlike any other archaeological site I've ever been to. If I've been to archaeological sites in Britain or Europe, you know, you sit and you marvel upon a single piece. Here, you cannot walk because there is just such an abundance of archaeology. And it ranges from about 850 to the 11th century. And if you just kneel down, the range of pots and pottery, it's completely bewildering. Some of it's plain, some of it decorated, some of it with that kind of woven, textured outer surface that we saw that was 11,000 years old. And I remember picking up the base of a heavily decorated pot that had been created when Djene Djeno was at its height. And it was obvious, even from superficial inspection, that the people had demanded a complex and sophisticated range of property, of pottery, that was serving a really diverse culture. These were people who were incredibly sophisticated, who had taste. And they were probably trading, when you look at the range of pots, with people from right across the region, from right across the Sahara, from right across southern Europe and into Asia. And that was about the economic pull, the dynamism, the liberalism of this place. And this was a region that was trading at the sort of time that Timbuktu rose to prominence. And it was the fulcrum of those ancient empires like Ghana and Mali. And it was an area that actually derived massive wealth from refining this newly available material, gold, that completely transformed the region. I mean, the desert was traditionally almost an impenetrable barrier. I mean, the Carthaginians, that they try to find ways across the desert, but they only find way, they only really through Berber traders do they find a way that is, it only kind of is a trickle of trade, really. I mean, the sorts of transport routes that were crossing back and forth from this region up into the north were tiny until this period in which Mansa Musa comes to prominence. And he realizes that in opening up these trade routes, that he can transform this region. And literally within a few generations, it is absolutely and profoundly transformed. But one of the ways in which he wants to transform it is intellectually. And he creates a highway which doesn't just bring in trade, but also brings in religion. And one of the developments that you can see that happens quite close is in a city which is adjacent to Djene Djenneh, which is Djene. And they developed a mosque here that was founded around 1200. It fell into disrepair in the 19th century and it was rebuilt in its present very impressive way. And the mosque is built from sun-baked bricks and mortar and coated in earth and plaster that gives a smooth, beautiful, organic, it's almost an other earthly type finish. It's huge. This is a vast, vast thing. And it completely dominates the Djene skyline even today. But the wonderful thing is just like the Dogon, just like the people of the Telem, is that the whole population of Djene, that they gather together to contribute to the maintenance of this wonderful building. It's reminiscent of, in its form, of the Telem granaries on the Bandagari escarpment. Like the granaries, the architecture isn't just functional, it is glorious. And the chevrons that have evolved, that were in the surface of those granaries, have evolved into these complex designs that you can see here as architectural motifs. What I'm fascinated by is the obvious cross-pollination, both across time and across geography. Timbuktu and Islam of the great Malian empires didn't just grow up in isolation. They blossomed in part from what was originally here. The constructions of buildings in Timbuktu, it doesn't resemble the Telem granaries for nothing, as the decoration lends from the Onjuga pottery design. This is something which was absolutely considered and thought about. As trade crisscrossed this region, so did ideas. The Dogon stories of origin might sit awkwardly with Islamic scriptures, but their ghosts absolutely stalk the Sufi songs that are sung in this region. That deep need to locate and explain their culture is all reminiscent of the intellectual traditions that were developed in Timbuktu. This is one culture with many manifestations. What each of these traditions, the grain carvings at Bandagara, the Dogon iconography, the ceramics and adobe buildings of Djenné have in common, is what remains so important about the documents of Timbuktu. They hold history, stories. And in doing that so effectively, they've become dangerous. They're physical symbols of a culture of cohesion that tells of 11,000 years of history. And unfortunately, it's the natural target for extremists, for iconoclasts, who want to destroy that unity and that narrative. In ways that are very concerning, Ansar Dean and their uncompromising followers have been very successful. The vandalism of buildings and documents has compromised a vital element of this very vulnerable history. It was Timbuktu that those disparate African cultural histories and intellectual traditions, it's where they came together. With thinking from right across North Africa, the Middle East, Europe, and they made a powerful, near unique form of African thinking. When medieval king Mansa Musa made Timbuktu his capital, he looked upon it as the Medici saw Florence, as a centre of a liberal intellectual empire that thrived on great ideas wherever they came from. Ansar Dean's idea of wanting to prune out those idolatrous symbols to purify Timbuktu, in my mind, is futile. The city, the culture, the very DNA of this region is so beautifully complex, so diverse, that in ways that will remain located in traditions derived from indigenous pre-Islamic cultures, that will be unchangeable. And the thing that made those pre-Islamic cultures so successful, that turned Mali into one of the wealthiest, most influential kingdoms in the medieval period, was their particular celebration of the finest intellectual traditions wherever they came from. And over the last 500 years, it is that liberal intellectual thinking that has kept Timbuktu as a respected cultural centre. I think we should work together to cherish and protect it. Whatever we can do to support the government in putting the Phoenix of the Desert back on its feet, I think we should do. But I have a feeling that the Phoenix of the Desert will fly again. I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
That was Gus Casely-Hayford speaking at last year's History Weekend Festival. We'll be returning to Malmesbury this year with 4 days of fantastic historical lectures. Tickets will be on sale from 29th of April, and you'll be able to purchase them and find out more information at historyweekend.com from that date. Well, that's almost all for this week. Do get in touch with your views on podcast@historyextra.com, and we'll do our best to read out some of your messages in future episodes. As well as email, you can also get in touch with us on social media. You can follow us on Twitter @HistoryExtra and like us on Facebook @facebook.com/HistoryExtra. Please do make sure to visit our website, historyextra.com, for all the latest history news, blogs, image galleries, quizzes and more. Next week, we'll be delving into the Victorian Rail Revolution with Di Drummond, while Ian Morris will be sharing his thoughts on the role of war in history. Do join us for that. Just before we go, a quick reminder that you can purchase several back issues of BBC History magazine for just 99 pence or 99 cents until Easter Monday on the iPad, iPhone, Kindle Fire and Google Play. Find us on the newsstand or else visit immediateapps.com to take advantage of this fantastic deal. The History Extra podcast was recorded on location in Devon and in Malmesbury and produced by Jack Fletcher.